Philosopher and Duke University professor Alex Rosenberg began an essay on scientism with a series of questions and his answers for each one. Is there a God? No. What is the nature of reality? What physics says it is? What is the purpose of the universe? There is none. What is the meaning of life? Ditto. Why am I here? Just dumb luck. Does prayer work? Of course not. Is there a soul? Is it immortal? Are you kidding? Is there free will? Not a chance. What happens when we die? Everything pretty much goes on as before, except us. What's the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? There is no moral difference between them. Is abortion, euthanasia, suicide, paying taxes, foreign aid, or anything else you don't like forbidden, permissible, or sometimes obligatory? Anything goes. Does history have any meaning and purpose? It is full of sound and fury, but signifies nothing. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Alex Rosenberg claims that he knows the answers to all those questions because of science. Science allows us no other possible answers. At this year's Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, Dr. Tiffany Schubert began by talking about the medieval cosmos, a cosmos full of meaning, harmony, and truth. And last week's After Dinner Scholar podcast is her lecture about the medieval cosmos. After she finished, we held a seminar discussing Alex Rosenberg's essay, Scientism versus the Theory of Mind, with that opening series of questions and his answers. Before the seminar began, to set the stage and avoid unnecessary intellectual whiplash, I spoke about how we got from a cosmos filled with the presence of God and with purpose to Rosenberg's comment that, quote, reality is the foresightless play of fermions and bosons, producing the illusion of purpose. The world of medieval cosmology and biology, and I'm tempted to say medieval science, but we'll hold that for a moment, is a long way from the cosmology and biology of Alex Rosenberg's scientism. Cosmology and biology reduced, in fact, simply to physics. We're clearly in a completely different world with, as Lewis suggested, a completely different worldview. And while we'll discuss the article in the seminar, I want to begin by offering an overview of how we got from scientia to scientism. And in this, I'm very indebted to Peter Harrison in his book, The Territories of Science and Religion. For St. Thomas and other medievals, scientia and its companion, religio, were virtues. Religio, writes Harris, refers to inner acts of devotion and prayer. He goes on, there is no sense in which religio refers to a system of propositional beliefs and no sense of different religions. That is, the word was never used in the way we use the word religion today, as in comparative religions. Scientia was an intellectual virtue, that is, a habit of mind, a personal attribute that moves our human intellectual powers toward perfection. It's not a system of propositional beliefs, which is where, of course, Rosenberg kind of begins with his ideas of science. Now, it's not that religio and scientia had no content. Take a gander at all the volumes of St. Thomas's writings, and you will understand the man believed in content. Similarly, as Lewis pointed out, there was plenty of content as the medievals observed and drew conclusions about the universe. Look at books like Ptolemy's Almagest, copied repeatedly and added to, even though he wrote in the 2nd century AD. Look at the cosmological intricacies of Dante's Comedy. There was plenty of content. The difference was the emphasis. We might be, for example, be tempted to think of a catechism as a statement of faith. It's what differentiates my church, my denomination, my religion from everybody else's. The medievals would not have been so tempted to do that, assuming they would have understood what we have in mind. Catechisms, and this would include the current catechism of the Catholic Church, Catechisms were primarily to advance virtue, in this case, the virtue of piety. The goal was to help people grow in their faith and in holiness, not to draw boundaries by means of data points. They understood scientia in the same way, as a virtue meant to perfect our intellectual powers. A similar idea to that of perfecting our piety. Scientia was, in fact, one of three intellectual virtues that included intellectus, or understanding, and sapientia, wisdom. Peter Harrison explains, understanding was to do with grasping first principles, science with a deriving of truths from those first principles, and wisdom with the grasp of the highest principle, including the first cause, God. He then goes on, to make progress in science then was not to add a body of systematic knowledge about the world, but was to become more adept at drawing scientific conclusions from general premises. Science was a mental habit, a way of looking at everything. Thomas Aquinas wrote, science can increase in itself by addition. Thus, when anyone learns several conclusions of geometry, the same specific habit of science increases in that man. And thus we have what we call the liberal arts, which back then were called the liberal sciences, with theology, the study of God, which is inextricably linked, of course, with piety. Theology is the queen of the sciences. Science, like religion, had to do with human perfection and human happiness. Progress in science and progress in religion were less about adding piles of new information in order to drive technology than they were about becoming a complete, wise, pious, and thus happy human being, fulfilling your God-given potential as a human created in His image. Knowing about nature, the cosmos, the plants, the animals, physics, mathematics, chemistry, enabled you to align your life with the truths that pervaded the cosmos. And going along with that is the notion of natural philosophy. In fact, you may have noticed that in C.S. Lewis, in quoting Albert the Great on page 42 of the reading packet, added a parenthesis. He talked about the scientists and then parenthesis, philosophos. At Wyoming Catholic College, we talk about the Bible being God's second book. And we told our freshmen last week before they headed off into the mountains that in class this year, they will be studying God's second book. While they're in the wilderness, we want them to contemplate God's first book, the book of creation. Medieval thinkers would have been quite happy with that idea, though they might have been more specific than we are. Everything in creation, they said, was designed to show us divine truth. So the sight of a moose wading in a pond eating water lilies is not simply something that creates a sense of awe. The moose had moral and theological significance and meaning that good medieval scientists, philosophos, could learn to recognize. And even though they didn't consider moose, as near as I can tell, this was all written down in medieval bestiaries to help us to grow in the intellectual virtues of scientia and sapientia, along with improving our temporal and eternal happiness. So what happened? Well, as Lewis pointed out, changes in the human mind produced a sufficient disrelish for the old model and a sufficient hankering for a new one. St. Thomas understood that God was not a being in the sense that you and I are beings. God is what Brad Gregory, in his book, The Unintended Reformation, calls the incomprehensible act of to be. What is your name? Moses asked at the burning bush in Exodus 3. I am who I am, was the answer. Or as the Dooley Rheims has it, I am who am. God is not the highest, biggest, most powerful, most awesome, most wise of all beings. He is beyond what we call being. He is beyond the isness that you and I and the squirrels and the rocks and the trees all share. In my edition of Martin Heidegger's Being in Time that I read back in college, there's a glossary at the end, and I still can quote the definition of being. In the glossary, it says, being is what is. There, I hope that clarifies it. God is beyond that definition. Now, that idea started to change in the 14th century with Duns Scotus and William of Ockham. They argued that you and I and the squirrel and the rock and the stars and God share this thing called being. And that seems as though it would make God more comprehensible, bring him perhaps down to our level, but at the same time, Scotus went beyond that to stress the utter transcendence of God. As Pope Benedict XVI said in his Regensburg address, we now had the idea that, quote, God's transcendence and otherness are so exalted that our reason, our sense of the good and true, are no longer an authentic mirror of God, whose deepest possibilities remain eternally unattainable and hidden behind his actual decisions. That is, God commands this, that, and the other thing in the Bible. God reveals himself in a certain way. What is God really like? We don't know. We can't know. Thomas and those before him said, we can know by analogy. We can know by reason, but God is even beyond reason from this new point of view. Add to that the Protestant Reformation that rejected the medieval synthesis as alien to the gospel and hung on to Duns Scotus and William of Ockham and to their nominalism. The Reformers' goal seemed reasonable enough. Go back to the Bible and believe what it says. Okay, what does it actually say? Ah, the fine print. Okay. Within a couple of decades, after Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the church door at Wittenberg, we had multiple churches all claiming that they knew what the Bible really said and that everybody else was a heretic. Protestants said just as many terrible things about each other as they said about Catholics. And the Reformation launched, in addition to the free market on Christianity, endless wrangling over doctrine, over the nature of God, over the nature of God's being, over the question of the sacraments that impinge on that, over the use of reason, and those arguments between Protestants and Catholics, yes, but very much between Protestants and Protestants. In the 18th century, noted Benedict in the same speech, quote, when philosopher Immanuel Kant stated that he needed to set thinking aside in order to make room for faith, he carried this program forward with a radicalism that the Reformers could never have foreseen. He thus anchored faith exclusively in practical reason, denying it access to reality as a whole, close quote. What then can we know? Brad Gregory concludes, empirical investigation of the natural world had not falsified any theological claims. Incompatible Catholic and Protestant views about the meaning of God's actions created an intellectually sterile impasse because of the objections they inevitably provoked from theological opponents and the intractable doctrinal controversies they constantly reinforced. What was left is a means of understanding the natural world, only reason, understood and exercised in ways that did not depend on any contested Christian doctrine. We see something similar taking place in this country after the Civil War. The title of Mark Knowles' book kind of says it all, The Civil War as a Theological Crisis. What should Christians, and most were Protestant at the time, what should Christians believe about slavery? Sola Scriptura. Go to the Bible, read the texts that address slavery, and then decide for yourself the clear, natural, obvious meaning of those passages and how to apply them. So Christians all over the United States read their Bibles and to decide for themselves. Those in the South
concluded that the Bible clearly says that God thinks slavery is just fine, while their brothers and sisters in the North concluded that slavery was an abomination to God. Okay, now what? Mark Knoll writes, "The country had a problem because its most trusted religious authority, the Bible, was sounding an uncertain note. The evangelical Protestant churches had a problem because the mere fact of trusting implicitly in the Bible was not solving disagreements about what the Bible taught concerning slavery. The country and the churches were both in trouble because the remedy that finally solved the question of how to interpret the Bible was recourse to arms. The supreme crisis over the Bible was that there existed no apparent biblical resolution to the crisis." Then Knoll adds, "It was left to those consummate theologians, the Reverend Doctors Ulysses S. Grant and William Tecumseh Sherman, to decide what the Bible actually meant." Added to the crisis over the Bible, Knoll points out there was a crisis over divine providence. Northerners and Southerners both had total confidence that God was on their side and that his providence would lead to a swift, decisive, final victory that would vindicate their faith and their biblical positions on slavery. Well, what happened instead? Abraham Lincoln's words in his second inaugural address sum it up. "Both read the same Bible," he said, "and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. Rivers of blood having been shed, Americans, particularly American elites, who were already losing interest in religion, lost all interest in religion, or at least lost interest in religion that claimed to be anything more than an inner light, or to use William James' definition from his 1902 book, Varieties of Religious Experience, religion that is, quote, the feelings, acts, and experiences of individual men in their solitude, so far as they apprehend themselves to stand in relation to whatever they may consider divine. That kind of subjectivity is a long way from religion as virtue." Add to that the rejection of religion by prominent thinkers of the era, Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, Charles Darwin. Add the doubts thrown on the veracity and the authority of the Bible by the so-called higher criticism and the triumph of Protestant liberalism. Religious truth became inward, subjective, highly personal, and in the final analysis, innocuous and irrelevant. Science was where the real action was. Science was about facts, not feelings, not sentiments. With science, you can know things for certain and help the world by controlling it for human good. And while the habit of talking about God remained firmly entrenched until the 19th century, with Francis Bacon, the Royal Society, René Descartes, Thomas Hobbes, and others, theology was being excluded from their investigations of the natural world. In the process, science as an intellectual virtue gave way to science as a body of knowledge, or assorted bodies of knowledge, to the scientific method of experimentation, and to the emergence of the scientist, not as a philosopher, but as a professional explorer of, guide to, and custodian of that knowledge. In fact, the word scientist, in the way we use it today, was not coined until the 1820s. Nature was no longer something to be observed and discovered by deduction, no longer a reservoir of moral and theological lessons. It was taken into a lab and, to use, I believe it's Francis Bacon's term, tortured until it gave up its secrets. And those secrets were the facts, just the facts, ma'am. C.S. Lewis pointed out in his book, The Abolition of Man, that the high water mark of magic was not the Middle Ages, but the 16th and 17th centuries. There was what Lewis calls a magician's bargain struck. quote, that process whereby man surrenders object after object and finally himself to nature in return for power. There is something which unites magic and applied science while separating both from the wisdom of earlier ages, Lewis continued. For the wise man of old, the cardinal problem was how to conform the soul to reality, and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. The solution is technique, and both, in the practice of this technique, were ready to do things hitherto regarded as disgusting and impious, such as digging up and mutilating the dead, or possibly we could add creating and mutilating the just conceived embryos to get the stem cells and other useful, financially rewarding parts. Science triumphed over magic only because, as Alex Rosenberg notes, it had the greater predictive power. That is, it worked. Science, like religion, went from being a virtue that tends to the perfecting of our human nature in accordance with nature to a body of propositions, of data. The purpose of science is not happiness by fitting ourselves into reality as created by the God who is beyond reality. Rather, the purpose of science is happiness by controlling, molding, torturing reality to discover its ways so that we might reorder it to fit our ideas of the good and of reality. God, by even the 19th century, had dropped out of the whole enterprise. Science is about facts. God, if he exists at all, is about values, emotions, and sentiment. Whatever we cannot measure, codify, experiment on, or use in practical ways either doesn't exist or is mostly meaningless. And so we come to Alex Rosenberg's plea for us to face the facts, the only facts that exist, the scientific facts.
Once reality has been reduced to nothing more than the physics of elementary particles, we either have to pretend that life has purpose, meaning, and morality, or else, as someone put it, go full on Nietzsche. That is, reduce life to a power struggle with the strong getting what they want, regardless of what that happens to be. It's a depressing prospect. Of course, we did not leave our Wyoming School of Catholic Thought students in a meaningless universe, and we will not leave you there either. Next week, our podcast will begin putting God and the cosmos back together again. Oh, and mark your calendars for next year's Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, June 6th through 14th, 2021. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.